Our first case is People v. Weinstein, case number 9SC218. Are both parties ready? Just want to remind both parties that our argument is set for 30 minutes aside. Please state your name before you start and who you represent. Ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Susan Trin Almany. My attorney registration number is 26281, and I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Devin Scott Weinstein. This court granted cert on two issues, and today I'm going to focus on the first issue, which is whether the Court of Appeals erred in approving the trial court's affirmative defense concerning survival, scope, and applicability of the common law bonding agent's privilege, and in rejecting the petitioner's tendered affirmative defense instruction, particularly that on the bonding agent's privilege and on consent. The first part of this issue is the survival of the bonding agent's privilege.
So before you get started on that, can I get you to just start by addressing whether we even have to come to a conclusion about the bonding agent's privilege? What role does that play? And I think the state's going to argue that we don't have to reach or minimally reach that issue because this was not the principal's home. Can you address that for me?
Excuse me, could I, before you even do that, our audience, could you tell us a little about what the facts are?
Sure. So the facts involve two bonding agents, Mr. Weinstein and Mr. Oram, who had been assigned to arrest Mr. John Vigil, who was a fugitive. He had basically jumped his bond, and they were assigned by a bonding agency to arrest him. They were given Mr. John Vigil, in his bonding application, had given an address at King Street as his residence, and the arrest warrant for him had also listed King Street as his residence. So these agents, after going to the Jefferson County Courthouse and checking to make sure that he was not arrested on another warrant, they went to observe the King Street house for about an hour. They saw several people in the house. There was at least one male, and two males in the house, as well as two females in the house. After about an hour, they entered the residence and attempted to arrest Mr. Vigil. Unfortunately, the person they arrested was not Mr. Vigil. It was a guest at the home, who was Mr. Martinez. But as soon as they found out that Mr. Martinez was not, in fact, John Vigil, they removed the handcuffs and they let him go. The question then is whether or not, as has been raised in this appeal, whether the bail bondsman's privilege applied to these facts, where the residents, there was dispute at trial. I should back up and say that there was dispute as to whether this residence was that of Mr. John Vigil. As I indicated, the residence was listed on his bonding application. It was listed in his arrest warrant. It was also his childhood address, and in fact, his brother, I should mention, was the co-signer of the bonding application, and his brother still lived at that address. There was testimony at trial that Mr. Vigil himself had not lived at that address for quite a long time. He had lived there as a child, but not recently. So the question is, if this was in fact not his actual residence, does the bonding agent's privilege apply?
Can I just ask you one factual question before we get back to Justice Hyde's question?
Sure.
The brother who co-signed the bond in the first place, his name was?
His name is Eugene Vigil.
Eugene Vigil. And did Eugene Vigil give consent to search his home at 1445 King Street?
Well, from my understanding,
in the bond
so
document,
the bonding application has the applicant, who is John Vehill, give that consent. And he listed that address and gave consent. Now, Eugene Vehill then also signed as the co-signer, but it's arguable that he also gave consent, or perhaps he didn't, and that was an argument. But I would note to the court that in the district court actually did say that both John Vehill and Eugene Vehill gave consent. But what the district court found was, even though they both gave consent, the district court believed that consent had to be given by one of the named victims, which was Mr. Martinez and the other two women who were in the home at the time. So the district court actually assumed consent from Eugene Vehill, even though that was an argument that was raised, whether or not it was Eugene as well as John who gave consent. But to address Justice Ide's question, yes, this bonding agent's privilege does need to be addressed in this case, because the question is not whether the residence was actually the residence of the fugitive, but instead the question is whether the bonding agents reasonably believed it was the residence of the principal, John Vehill. So I think to ask just a simple factual question of whether the residence actually was that of John Vehill oversimplifies the issue. In general, the case law does not, the case law in general applies a reasonable belief analysis to the bonding agent's actions when they attempt to arrest the principal. So even though there are cases that say the bonding agent's privilege does not extend to third party residences, those cases all involve a fugitive or a principal who has been arrested inside a true third party's residence, such as he happens to be visiting somebody and agents come in, enter the residence, and arrest. There's no question whether there is a reasonable belief that that residence belonged or was the residence of the principal. In those cases, it's just a true third party residence. So I don't think that those cases really help determine this case before the court. Because in this case, there is actually a reasonable belief that this is the residence of John Vehill. And there are numerous facts that support that. As I've indicated, there's the fact that it's on his bonding application, it's on his arrest warrant. His brother and co-signer of the bond also listed that address on the bond and, in fact, resided there. And, it was his residence at some point in time, although the facts are actually unclear as to, you know, how much or when the last time he actually slept there was. But he certainly received his mail there. And so, for all legal purposes, this was his residence. Frankly, there's no indication in the record of any other residence that he had. So there was certainly abundant evidence and facts to support the bonding agent's reasonable belief.
What is the, assuming you're right for a second, Ms. Almey, what does that go to? What conclusion do we draw from that? Do you want us to draw from that?
Well, that if they reasonably believed that that this was the residence, then the bonding privilege applies to them. If this was,
why does the bonding privilege apply in the first place? What's your argument for that? Forgetting the facts for a second.
Well, I'm sorry. So why does it?
What's the argument to even apply the bonding? I can make the argument. I guess I will. And hear what you say, that under our statutes, first of all, there are no criminal law crimes, as you know, but when we adopted the Model Penal Code in 1971, and under our code, under 1810-1031, it's pretty clear that the only defenses that apply to a statutory crime. So isn't the bonding agent a common law defense that comes from a dicta in an old United States Supreme Court case?
Yes.
So what's the argument that it doesn't apply in Colorado? Or what's the argument against it doesn't apply? I'm sorry.
This is a common law privilege. There is, of course...
We don't have common law crimes, right, in Colorado? They're outlawed, as far as I know.
Right, so this wouldn't be a common law crime.
Right, it's a statutory crime that charges burglary.
I'm sorry, you're saying the bonding agent's privilege...
The bonding agent privilege...
Is a crime?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Would be an affirmative defense.
To
a statutory crime, and basically our statutes say that it's only the only kind of defense, affirmative defense you can raise is an affirmative defense.
Right. So we are...
A statutory affirmative defense.
So we would be arguing that this is an affirmative defense to the statutory crime of burglary, as well as menacing.
Why?
Because, first of all, it's an affirmative defense. Because it's very similar to the affirmative defense that's in 18.1707 for police officers and citizens making a citizen's arrest.
Right.
So we're calling it affirmative defense.
But these are bounty agents or bounty hunters,
right,
not police officers. So.
Exactly. So they're a hybrid of police officers and citizens who make a private citizen's arrest.
Is there any statute that says that?
No, but I think just by the nature of their duties, they've been given authority, statutory authority, to make such an arrest. But they're, of course, not officers, as we know, so they...
Does the statutory authority say that they have a right to go into someone's home, the third party's home?
No, it does not. So that is the question. The statute only says that they have the authority to make the arrest, but it does not specify how they can make that arrest. So that's when we turn to the common law on with the whole Taylor line of cases. And the common law then explains how they can make that arrest and does go into the third-party residence issue, but as I've stated, those third-party cases don't really help in our situation because here the residence was one that the bonding agents could reasonably believe was that of the principal. I'm sorry, did I answer your question on whether or not this is a defense that can be applied?
I think you did. You said, my understanding what you said, correct me if, was that basically we're applying a common law defense to a statutory crime.
Yes. Yes.
Or another way of arguing that would be that we're going to take the statutory authorization for bonding agents, which doesn't say anything about going into a home, and interpreting that to be consistent with the common law privilege, which is the affirmative defense, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. I'd like to turn to the issue of the people's argument that any error would be harmless error.
Before you totally leave that last segment, it seems to me this is sort of the heart of the question, at least for us to start with, is whether this common law privilege, first of all, I think there may be some question, it looks like, raised about exactly what the common law privilege is, and we could worry about that another time. But first, getting back to the Chief's question, whether it has survived the adoption of our criminal code. I'm not sure, I understand you to be asserting that it has, but I'm not sure that you've given a reason for why the language of the criminal code doesn't abolish a common law defense as well as a common law crime. And in addition to that, I wonder if you could address the question that the statutes specifically provide for some privilege on the part of a bonding agent, but they don't go nearly as far as the common law privilege you're asserting. Why do you think we should assume that the legislature intended that a defense like this would survive in the face of what they have provided for?
Sure, and that really goes to the whole issue of statutory abrogation, which is the principle that basically that when a legislature creates a statute, if that statute manifests an intent to abrogate the common law, either explicitly or implicitly, or actually either by explicit statutory language or by clear implication is the analysis there. So in this case, as you know, Taylor, I think that case was decided in the late 1800s. And then Colorado enacted Section 16-4-108, which recognizes a bonding agent's authority to seize a principal. But that's all it does. It doesn't actually prescribe how the bonding agent may exercise his power to seize the principal. It just says, yes, bonding agents have that authority. So that's all the statute actually provides for. And since it doesn't provide for the details of how that arrest is completed, then we have to revert to the common law because there's been no statutory abrogation.
Yet, if I may interrupt you, I think where the Chief and Justice Coates are going is that in addition to that, sort of a general principle expressed in 18-1-103-1 suggests that the provisions of the code govern not only the construction and punishment for defined offenses, but the code also governs construction of any affirmative defense. So if you're characterizing the privilege here as an affirmative defense, then 18-1-103 would suggest that that needs to be likewise codified in statute as opposed to the common law. So I think, unless misconstrued the argument, I think that's the point they're trying to make.
Okay.
And so why then, in light of 18-1-103, can we reach into the common law to define this privilege slash common law defense?
I see what you're saying, yes. And that's a very good question. And to be honest, I think that in general, yes, as an affirmative defense, that would be codified. And yeah, our argument is that unfortunately it's not, it isn't codified, but it's likened to the statute for police officers and private citizens. And so we would be kind of tagging on to Section 18-1707, which does provide the affirmative defense for police officers and private citizens. And I emphasize in private citizens arrest affecting a citizen's arrest because I think that's an important part.
Aren't there some guidelines on how that has to occur, though? I mean, a police officer just can't go break into a home that's entitled to protection, right? I mean,
that's right.
I mean, you usually have to have a warrant or you have to have probable cause and the person's a fugitive.
And in fact, this Supreme Court in People v. Arness, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case, says law enforcement officials entering a residence to serve an arrest warrant must have a reasonable belief that the suspect lives at the residence and is in the residence at the time of entry. So again, I think that
is in the residence at the time of entry.
Right. Now, a reasonable belief that he was in the residence at the time of entry.
Okay, now.
So, and that's our argument for the bail bondsman.
Simply on the basis that he put down that his address was, that was his address?
I'm sorry?
Was there any other background check before these bail bondsmen went into this house?
I think they went to the Jefferson County District Court.
I'm talking about the belief that the person was actually inside there at the time they were effectuating the seizure.
Well, they had observed the house for about an hour.
And?
They had observed, they were looking for a Hispanic male. They had observed at least one Hispanic male in the house.
That's all it takes, is in a house and a Hispanic male and an Hispanic that has signed the surety bond. Is that your position?
Well, my position is that they had a reasonable belief that, because they believed that, they had a reasonable belief that this was John Vigil's residence, and then they saw a male that, from their vantage point, appeared to match that of the fugitive, that they did have a reasonable belief. I think there are situations that you can, where perhaps there's no one in the house, or there's just a woman in the house. So then there's no reasonable belief. They're just, you know, entering the residence. But here, there were facts supporting a reasonable belief that he was, in fact, in the house, although, of course, they were mistaken.
Let me take you back to your argument that you get an affirmative defense by tagging along with the officers and citizens' authority to arrest. And although I understand that were you to argue, which hasn't been your argument, that the bonding agents are entitled to whatever privileges or affirmative defenses that a private citizen might have, instead your argument is that somehow out of that comes bonding agent's affirmative defense. And I guess my question is, shouldn't we actually presume the opposite? That is, since bonding agents weren't mentioned, police officers and private citizens were, it seems to indicate a contrary legislative intent.
I don't know that it indicates a contrary legislative intent as much as it was overlooked, and perhaps due to the fact that there was common law regarding a bail bondsman's privilege, that that it was overlooked for that reason.
Sami, can I ask you, are you aware of any other case law that in the state of Colorado that adopts a common law affirmative defense that is not part and parcel of an actual statutory affirmative defense?
I am not, Your Honor. I can look into that, but I don't have any case law at the moment.
Now, do you have an alternate theory that actually there's a contract that allows, or there's a consent that was issued that allows the entry? And how far can you get with that one?
I'm sorry?
I want to know how far that goes.
Okay. The consent issue, I think, is actually an important one, and that was also an affirmative defense instruction that the defense had tendered and that the district court denied. And in denying the consent, well, I just want to go back to the facts that support the consent instruction. So again, John Vigil signed the bonding application and gave his consent. Eugene Vigil co-signed that bonding application.
What's the language of that consent? Can you read it to me? I don't have it in front of me.
You mean in the application itself?
Yeah, the bonding.
I don't think I have it right in front of me. I think I have it back there, but I can on rebuttal.
I'd like to know what the wording is.
But
sure, that's fine.
It's basically a checklist.
Is it a consent to enter into the home? Is
yes,
that identified?
Consent to enter into the home, and then there's actually subparagraphs where he had to initial next to each subparagraph saying, and they can do this, and they can, you know, they can enter by jump my bond, you know, and so on. And so there are actually numerous paragraphs which he, John Vigil, initialed. And then Eugene Vigil co-signed that application. So and the district court found that by co-signing that bonding application, that both John and Eugene gave consent. But what the district court found was even though both John and Eugene gave consent, it didn't matter because the consent had to come from a named victim, which were Mr. Martinez and the two women.
The consent, I haven't seen the written form, but it was a consent to enter the house that hit the residence, King Street residence at any time, or is it limited to if the defendant was there physically?
Yes.
What do you mean, yes?
The language actually says that it basically echoes the language from the Taylor case and says, and this is an interest, it says if necessary, they can enter to seize him if he has, you know. And so part of the analysis that this court needs to make is what the if necessary language means, and whether that if necessary should be strictly construed, or as is the case in many cases have indicated, that if necessary should is oftentimes no more than a reasonable standard. So again, going back to that reasonable belief language.
Oh, well, if take a look at the consent issue and the facts, that would clearly go to the subjective nature of the mens rea of the burglary, right?
Yes.
All right. But what about menacing? What's your argument on supporting the conviction for menacing? Or not supporting it, but attacking him, sorry.
Well, on the menacing, if there was, and you're talking about...
Our two convictions is burglary and menacing, right?
Right.
So?
Well, the consent issue, frankly, really goes to the burglary issue.
Sorry, though, I didn't just hear that.
The consent defense really goes to the burglary issue. We would argue that the bail bonding agent's privilege goes to both, but consent would go to burglary. Okay.
So your position is basically the menacing conviction should be reversed because of the survival of the bonding agent's privilege, however we might define it.
That's correct.
At least bail bondsman didn't have a photograph of...
They did not have a photograph, no. They looked for one. They didn't have one in their own file, and they looked for one at the Jefferson County District Court.
And then they didn't wait to see whether a person matching his name by going up to him and asking him what was there. I'm trying to get, again, at the reasonableness of the belief, since apparently everything you've argued, I mean, hinges on the reasonableness of the belief.
Right.
It seems to me, based on this incident, they simply barged in there, and when they were contradicted about their right to be there, you know, basically were profane and said, we have the right to be here, standing in somebody else's house with people that are completely not the right people. So how do you even get to near with the facts you have there that this is a reasonable effort by a bail bondsman to carry out his job, which has got to have some circumscribing conditions to it in the interest of the safety of the public? Are these people armed, by the way?
They were armed with a taser gun.
Okay. They have it out?
I'm sorry?
Did they have
it
out?
They did pull it out when they arrested Mr. Martinez.
Put him in cuffs.
And they put him in cuffs. And then as soon as...
They had no description of the man they were seeking.
Well, they did have a description. So what happened is they had a description, and when they approached the house, one of the women from the house came out and said, what do you want, or something to that effect, and they said, what's your name, and Mr. Martinez said Joe Martinez, but they thought he said John Martinez, and so their immediate reaction was not Joe, but they said John Vigo, because what Joe Martinez said was just Joe. He didn't say his last name. He said, my name's Joe. So as soon as he said Joe, they said, John Vigo, you're under arrest. So they misheard Joe for John, but it's clear that they didn't think they were arresting Joe. They thought they were arresting John. So when you're looking for facts that support a reasonable belief, I think that under the facts of this case, I'm not sure what other facts they could have
asked. Sounds like a wild and inaccurate surmise.
Well, the address, first of all, there are two things that there's a reasonable belief for. One is a reasonable belief that this is the residence of John Vigo, and the second is there's a reasonable belief that John Vigo is in the house at that time.
And that the person that put the cuffs on was John Vigo.
Right, right. So, you know, under the circumstances of this case, I think certainly there was a reasonable belief that this was his house. The documentation supported that. The question then is, was there a reasonable belief that Joe Martinez was John Vigil? And of course there was a mistake. We're not questioning that, but I think that based on the facts of the case, they did reasonably believe it was John Vigil simply because he was in the house, he was a Hispanic male, he was about the same size, it was dark, so they couldn't really see his features. So quite frankly, I'm not even sure that a photograph would have made that significant of a difference, even though that would have been helpful. But it was difficult for them to see his features. But once they determined that he was not John Vigil, they did remove the handcuffs. So the facts indicate that they had that reasonable belief, even though it was a mistaken belief. They were not going in there and just saying, we feel like just arresting anyone.
Salmi, I think your time is up. Thank you very much.
So. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Hansen, Senior Assistant Attorney General, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I find myself in unfamiliar territory here, basically defending two lower courts ruling that I believe were only partially correct. And I'd actually like to focus on the first two things that I think from the Court of Appeals particularly that were incorrect, that I think actually resolved this case and dispose of this, although of course I do agree with the Court of Appeals' ultimate conclusion that the conviction should be affirmed. First, basically, even if there's a bonding privilege, and even if it survives the statutory, which I'd like to talk next about, there was no factual dispute whatsoever that John Vigil lived at that residence. The Court of Appeals found that there was. I don't know that the trial court made a specific finding that there was a factual dispute, just decided to give the instruction. But there's a difference between evidence in the record and the defendant's belief of a certain fact. When we're looking at whether if there's a bonding unit privilege, it applies if it's in fact the principal's residence. There was no evidence here whatsoever other than the fact that it was not his residence.
Well, I'm sorry, but what about the evidence that he, in the consent form, that he stated that was his address?
John Vigil only. Eugene Vigil did not bond application. So only John Vigil listed that was his address. And I disagree. Certainly the fact that it's on the warrant has nothing to do with John Vigil's representation. So he did state that, however, doesn't create a factual dispute whether he in fact lived there. It goes to whether the bondsman might have reasonably believed.
Why isn't it some evidence that he lived there? I mean, ordinarily, it seems in any minor civil case, someone states that's what their address is. That's, you know, at least some evidence that that's their address, isn't it?
I don't believe so. I believe that the evidence that was actually introduced at trial as to, it was evidence that he stated to the bondsman that he lived there, but it wasn't evidence that he in fact lived there. And that's the important thing.
What's the difference between that he stated he lived there and that he in fact lived there?
Because the bondsman privilege only applies whether he in fact lived there. So that's what the fact is, whether he lived there under the bonding privilege, not whether he said he did.
So let's assume for a moment there was more evidence that he lived there, but still lots of evidence that he did not. So this is an issue that the court has to decide, whether there's a certain amount of evidence that he lives there before some privilege or consent would be permitted as a defense?
Yeah, I mean, with any jury instruction, the court has to decide whether there's a scintilla.
What would be that, a scintilla? So you're saying his representation that he lived there is not even a scintilla of evidence?
Yes, I am. Because of the fact that the bonding agent privilege does not apply unless he in fact lived there. Reasonable mistake, you look at our next case, a reasonable mistake as to whether he lived there isn't going to justify the police officer's entry. And so that privilege under Payton to go into a house to execute an arrest warrant only applies if it is in fact the defendant's residence.
Why isn't it a jury determination of whether that's his residence or not?
Because there was no evidence presented to contradict the evidence presented he didn't live there. It's just my position that simply stating on the bond application didn't create evidence that he did in fact live there. It created evidence from which the bondsman could have believed that he did, and there goes forward to the sufficiency of the evidence, but it didn't create that he did in fact live there, and because that's what's required by the bonding privilege, I don't think it was warranted in the first place.
I follow up to just see if I can, I'm not sure if you're saying that the his application didn't constitute evidence, or you really mean that if he said that he lived there, that would not be evidence that he lived there. Suppose he was actually called as a witness and he took the stand and he said, I lived there. Would that be evidence that he lived there?
Yes. And I do believe that the application was evidence that he told the bondsman that he lived there. But I don't think that's evidence that he, in fact, lived there.
So are you saying to be evidence that he lived there, he would have to testify to the jury rather than simply evidence coming in that he told other people that he lived there?
Yes, I believe so. Because I believe the ultimate question is whether he, in fact, lived there. So whether he told people that, I don't think...
I think we all agree with that. The only question is, what would constitute some evidence that he lived there?
Him saying he lived there, someone else saying he lived there.
But him telling someone else in the bond application that he lived there is not good enough evidence that he says he lives there. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Why is that? I mean, you don't seem to be saying that it's inadmissible.
No.
You're just saying it's not enough evidence.
I'm saying that the question under the bonding privilege is, did he in fact live there? The evidence from all the witnesses was he did not in fact live there. The bonding application said he told Ms. Mullins that he lived there. That's not the same as saying he does in fact live there, that there was evidence that he does in fact live there. That's my position. And I believe that under this case, you as I noted in my answer brief, I think defendants who are attempting to get out of jail on bond, it certainly is not unheard of that they might list an address. In fact, in this case, we don't even know where his address was. He may not have had a residence. And so I think that not only is it not any evidence that he did in fact live there, it's certainly not credible evidence that he lived there. And that's required before the instruction would be warranted in the first place. But if we move past this issue and decide, I would like to talk about what I believe is the Court of Appeals' second issue or second erroneous conclusion, which in and of itself also disposes of this case, is whether or not there is in fact a common law bonding privilege and then whether it survives in Colorado. And as I argued, I think what we have here is a common law privilege, which I think Taylor versus Tainter adequately reflects the common law privilege. However, as this court recognized, we abolished common law crimes. We set forth in 18.1710 the fact that these are affirmative defenses. These are statutory affirmative defenses. There's no affirmative defense under 18.1701 at SEC that addresses the bondsman's privilege whatsoever. In fact, the only two that even remotely go to this issue are 2703 and 707 that deal with the power to arrest. 703 specifically sets forth certain people that are allowed to do that, does not list bondsmen at all. 707 deals with citizens' arrest. However, the citizens' arrest issue would not apply here because under 163201, which addresses a citizen's arrest, that only applies if the person conducting the arrest actually observes the crime. And the crime here, if anything, was violation of bail bond conditions. It was an FTA. And so basically when they went in the house to effect an arrest, they didn't witness any crime at all. And so 707 doesn't apply at all either. And so then you look at the other statutes that we have. And we do have the statute 164108 that addresses the right to arrest. And I think if you look at the fact that the common law privilege had been in existence for hundreds of years, when they set forth the statute, the right to arrest, and the fact that they did not also allow for entry into the principal's residence is evidence that they meant to statutorily abrogate the common law privilege in Colorado.
Counsel, can you just follow up on that? I mean, I guess the counter-argue to that, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but is essentially that this wasn't intentionally leaving out the privilege. It just didn't mention, it just leaves it blank, essentially, with regard to how that arrest is supposed to be conducted. That just isn't mentioned in the statute, and therefore we have to fill that in somehow.
And how we fill that in is the trespass and burglary statutes, which only allow for entry into another's premises with consent. And so I think if you combine the fact that they allowed for arrest by a bondsman without mentioning how, and then you have otherwise statutes that prevent entry into a residence without consent, that demonstrates, in addition to the fact that the court was aware, presumably, of the common law at the time and could have included that in to the 16-40108, the right to enter the residence. I think all of that demonstrates, actually affirmatively demonstrates, an intent to abrogate the common law privilege in Colorado.
But that a person that owned the house or lived in the house gave consent for the entry on the form?
They did not. Mr. Vigil did not sign the bond application form, and the application form was the only one that included the consent, which was essentially in the language of Taylor versus Tainter. There was what's been quoted over and over again, the right to enter the principal's residence if necessary to effect the arrest. Eugene Vigil, in fact, specifically testified he never even saw that application. He co-signed on the bond itself. And so we don't have any consent from anyone who lived there. And I think that's what the trial court found when it was rejecting the tendered instruction on consent, was we don't have any evidence of consent from the victims in this case, who were the owner and residents of the home, Gina V. Hill. We certainly don't have consent. I don't think that should even be an issue as to the menacing.
Can I just, do you intend to be saying then, I could say agreeing, but do you believe that if the application does constitute some evidence of his residence, Mr. Vigil's, the fugitive Mr. Vigil's residence, that if we were to find that does constitute some evidence, then would you agree that the trial court erred by denying a defense of consent?
I believe that if you find that there is a factual dispute and some evidence that John Vigil did in fact live there, then certainly under 18-1505 he would have he would be one of the persons that could consent to entry, and that his bond application could have consented to the entry.
So even if we think that the privilege, the common law privilege, does not survive, if we were to believe there's a factual dispute, there's some evidence that that John Vigil did live at that residence, then you think it was error to deny a consent instruction?
No, I don't think it was error to deny the consent instruction, because they didn't ask for that I don't believe they asked for that in relation to the contractual relationship between John Vigil. I think they asked for that in conjunction with the common law privilege.
Burglary.
Right. It's
unknowingly, unlawfully.
Correct.
So if you have consent, obviously it's a lawful entry.
If you have consent, it's a lawful entry. But they did not ask for that consent instruction based on John V. Hill's consent in the bonding contract. And I believe, again, the fact that it's not factual evidence of his residence, that instruction was not warranted under the evidence either.
Actually, it was the first part of your answer there that I was trying to get at, to see what you thought about the scope of the request for a consent instruction and what that goes to, because in your brief, you separately deal with a contract theory, with a consent theory based on the if there's a contractual relationship based on the application. And what I'm wondering is, if we disagree with you about whether that constitutes some evidence, do you feel that the defense raised and requested an instruction that would have allowed the jury to rule on that contractual consent
theory? No, I don't believe they raised that in conjunction with the consent instruction. But basically, I think that if there was a factual, if there was sufficient evidence, let's say, to give the consent instruction with regard to John V. Hill's consent to enter his home, and if the jury could somehow find that based on the evidence that was in fact his home and therefore he could consent, then perhaps had the defense requested it, it should have been given. I would say in this case, since, you know, certainly they didn't request it in conjunction with that, and so it didn't need to be given. However, any error in not giving the consent instruction in conjunction with John V. Hill's contract with the bail bondsman certainly would have been harmless under the facts of this case, because there was absolutely no evidence. Again, if anything, the evidence was very, very weak that he had the authority to give consent.
Sanson, could you shift gears just for a second? I'd like to hear your discussion of, at least my understanding is that for burglary, the culpable mental state of knowingly is, on our case, consistent with our case law, is a subjective knowingly. So how do you support the conviction in this case on the facts, where there seems to be an argument and evidence that that they had a reasonable belief that he was in the home?
Well, I disagree.
At the time of entry, at the point of entry.
Okay. I disagree with counsel's statement of the facts with regard to the reasonable belief. And there is no language in the bondsman's privilege or anything else that talks about a reasonable belief that they're there. The language is actually necessary.
I think this is a separate argument having nothing whatsoever to do.
Okay.
But I have the power to arrest somebody under the statute, as you've pointed out. And they have a reasonable belief based on the arrest warrant, based on his signature on the bond, that he lives at 1445 King Street. And so they go and they knock on the door and they think he's in there. So that's the issue. What's your argument about that on the facts?
On the facts, they don't have a reasonable belief that he's in there. They have no basis to believe that he's in there.
That's because they didn't see him, like in Arnaz they did.
Well, there's several different things. Yes, correct. That's one of the main things. They had reason to suspect that that was, in fact, not his residence. They called the phone numbers. They were all disconnected. Eugene Vigil listed on the bond itself his address as 1445 or 6 King Street. And so that should have given them pause as to why they both live there. These are two adult males, which is not impossible for a family to be living together. But that should have. These are all reasons to give them pause. And then they do very minimal investigation. They do not get a picture of him. Then they go the very night that they're hired, and they wait for an hour. And when they're waiting for an hour, they see no one. They don't see Eugene V. Hill. He's out of the house. They don't see anyone in the house whatsoever until they come up to the door. They come up to the door. I believe it was Gina or Zandra, I'm not sure, one of the women answered, I think it was Gina, answered the door. And they represented themselves as police officers, and so they were investigating a complaint. Gina, so they had an actual conversation until the entry. Gina said, you know, what's the complaint about? And he ignored her and asked what their names were. And so it wasn't until then that they saw Joe, who is 30 years younger than John V. Hill. So he may be a Hispanic male, he may be the same build, but he's 30 years younger. And so I think that the jury could have determined that, and basically discredited Mr. Orem's testimony that when Joe said Joe, he thought he meant John. And I think that the jury could have concluded that they had no belief that the guy was in there at that time. Certainly the evidence didn't establish that John V. Hill was there. In fact, all the evidence indicated to the contrary. They saw no man matching his description whatsoever there. Yet they entered, they threw people to the ground, they handcuffed people, they handcuffed Joe, and only until he provided identification did they realize they had made a mistake. And so I think that demonstrates, I think the fact that they falsely represented themselves as police officers is actually strong evidence that they knew that their conduct was unlawful. If they thought that they had every right to be there and enter the home to arrest John V. Hill, what's the need for the ruse? And not only the initial ruse, but they perpetuated it long into that. They kept saying, we're here. I think Mr. Orem said, we have a right, I can do whatever I want. They told the occupants, even Eugene Vigil, when he came home, that they were FBI and police agents, They gave the phone number listing Detective Scott as the name. And so I think when we're talking about the subjective state of mind, that's the evidence that goes to their knowledge that they knew that they were doing something that they weren't supposed to be doing and that they didn't have a basis to be doing what they're doing. And if we do, if we do get to the bonding privilege and say they had a right to enter, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that that right to enter is not absolute, that it's qualified by the if necessary language, which appears in the common law. And the Court of Appeals resolution of the if necessary part of the sufficiency of the evidence was also correct in that because they had no information at that time that he was there, I think that alone absolutely it contradicts the notion that it was necessary to enter at that time. It's just common sense. It's not necessary to enter when they're not there.
If I might interrupt you, I think I'm understanding you to say that's on the assumption that this privilege even continues today.
Correct.
Okay. But your main contention is that it does not.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I just didn't feel it was a good idea for me to argue there's no bonding privilege in Colorado. And even if there is, there's no factual dispute, and that's the end of it. I wanted to provide this court with analysis, the people's position on if the bonding privilege does exist, how should it be applied in this case, and how does it affect the sufficiency of the evidence? And so basically, if it applies, even considering the privilege, which is not an affirmative defense, it certainly is not listed in the statutory affirmative defenses, and even if the common law privilege applies, despite that fact, an affirmative defense is something that admits to the elements but seeks to excuse itself, the conduct, for some other reason. Here he's disputing the element of unlawful entry. He's disputing the element of intent to commit a crime therein. And so it's not an affirmative defense at all. In fact, it's more like intoxication, which is just an evidentiary rule that's intended to guide the jury in deciding whether the person's conduct met a certain element or not.
I didn't really understand your argument on that part. It seems to me, it sounded to me from the briefs, and maybe with what you're saying here, less that you're arguing it's not an affirmative defense than that you're arguing you can't have conflicting defenses, so you can't seek to traverse the elements and also get an affirmative defense instruction. But we've never required, have we? I mean, I know an affirmative defense derives from what we call the plea and confession and avoidance, but we've never required that a defendant affirmatively admit commission of the elements in order to get an instruction of excuse or justification, have we?
I believe you have. I mean, I believe I cited one case that was quoted, and I apologize, it could be a Court of Appeals case, but I believe this court recognized in Harlan specifically that affirmative defense works by admitting the elements of the offense or not disputing the elements of the offense, but seeking to somehow justify and excuse the mitigate the conduct because of some other factor.
So you think in Colorado we would not, a defendant could never assert, it wasn't me, I was in Mexico, but if I was there, it was self-defense? You'd think that would never be allowed.
I think that's perfectly okay. But saying it's not me, I'm not in Mexico, is not an affirmative defense. I'm saying that you can't have an affirmative defense instruction. It's not an affirmative defense when you're disputing the elements. If that's the case, it's just simply a defense.
But you're disputing the elements if you say you aren't the one who committed the act, aren't
correct.
You?
Correct. But right. Just disputing the elements doesn't necessarily require the prosecution to disprove elements of the affirmative defense. And that's the only distinction here and why I think it's important to decide whether it's an affirmative defense or not. If it's an affirmative defense, the prosecution has to disprove elements. And that's exactly why it's not, because in disproving the elements of the offense, it's necessarily disproving the affirmative defense.
Is your point that it's not a true affirmative defense?
Yes.
And we probably both know that the legislature has often used that terminology, and not quite how probably we would choose to use it, but that it is instead negating an element. And your point is that the instructions on the elements are sufficient, and you don't need an additional consent instruction. Is that the point that you're making?
No, I think if the what should have happened here is if the common law privilege applied, if you feel it survives the statutes. What should have happened here is the court should have, and if there's a factual dispute as to whether it applies based on the residence, what the court should have done, what this was essentially is a mistake of fact defense. And the court should have given a mistake of fact instruction. Of course, it wasn't requested here at all. And then given the evidentiary instruction, like intoxication, guiding the jury into why he made that mistake of fact and whether his conduct was would be otherwise negating the elements, had that fact been as he thought it was. And that's why I talked about in my brief is truly this his defense was a mistake of fact. He thought it was the guy's house. And it was up to the jury to decide whether that belief was reasonable and whether he really subjectively believed that. So I think if this situation comes up in the future, and there is a factual dispute as to whether or not it is the person's residence, certainly if there's no factual dispute of this person's residence, either the bondsman's privilege, if it survives, applies or it doesn't.
Samson, I want to go to the burglary unknowingly, and it relates a little bit to the bondsman's privilege. I just don't understand how the facts here indicate a subjective intent to enter at the time he opened the door. All the people's names were Vigil that identified themselves. The brothers signed with the address at that. He signed with it. I'm just having a little trouble. And there's also, and here we are in, you know, on three different levels. The prosecution has admitted there's some sort of bonding agent privilege, so which is reflected in the language of the consent form, whether it's co-signed or not by the fugitive, the alleged fugitive, or he was a fugitive. So I don't quite understand how you get facts sufficient to support knowingly. That's my real issue here at the time, and I think that that really has to be evidence that they knew their conduct was unlawful at the time they, you know, broke an entry.
Correct.
Yeah. So I guess you need to run me by that.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just would like to correct. I'm not sure if I heard you right, but I don't think at any stage the prosecution has conceded that the bonding privilege applied. I know I argued in the Court of Appeals. And
the judge, okay, you may be right. The judge, you just argued it in front of us that some form of it might apply, right?
Well, no, I argue it doesn't apply, but if it does,
okay.
The instruction was not.
I stand corrected. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So basically, as I talked about, I agree that for sufficiency that we have to show that the defendant subjectively knew that they had no authority to enter. And I think if you take the evidence that I discussed previously, including their knowledge that there was some question about whether it's his house, their knowledge that it was not, their lack of belief that he was there. They had no reason to believe he was there. And I think, again, I think the ruse is really important because I think that's affirmative evidence that they knew that they had no authority to enter. I think that's very important because I think the fact that they said they represented themselves as police officers and they said, you know, we're coming in, we're looking for this guy. No one, I believe, gave their last name. So I certainly don't think they had any reason to believe at the point at which the people were in the foyer that they knew that he was there and then therefore had the right to enter. And I think the other thing, too, is the other aspect of it that goes to whether they knew their conduct was lawful or not is the if necessary. Because under the bonding privilege, they have to know it's the principal's residence and they have to know that it's necessary to go in. That's required under the bonding agent privilege if it applies. And so I think there's evidence that they knew that at that point it was not necessary to enter because they didn't know that he was there. They had no reason to believe he was there. They had time. They had not conducted a full investigation as to whether it's even really his address, and they had reason to suspect that it was not. And so I think you have to, when you're deciding the subjective intent, or the subjective knowledge that it was unlawful, you look at the ruse, you look at the questions as to whether it's his house, those things that I talked about. And
can I ask you a fact question?
Sure.
I'm not clear on this. All I remember, and which may be incorrect, is that they knocked on the door and then the door flew open.
No.
Something like that?
There was a brief conversation.
Before they entered?
Yes.
With Gina?
Yes. And they were able to see who was at the door. Like I said, they saw Joe.
Right, but then they entered.
Then they entered.
And what did Gina say? What's the testimony of what Gina said?
Well, they told them they were investigating, they were Denver police investigating a complaint. Gina asked, what's the complaint? They ignored her. They said, what's your name? Gina said, Gina.
She didn't say Gina V?
I don't believe so. And Joe, and even if she did, I mean, that doesn't establish that, that John V. Hill's there. And Joe said, Joe. And like I said, I understand Mr. Oron testified that he thought he said John.
And they went in?
And then they went in. That's okay. So I think it's important when you're deciding not, whether they knew their conduct was lawful, as the Court of Appeals did, you have to consider what's lawful. And the lawful here, if we believe it applies, is the requirements of the bonding privilege, which is both that it's the residence and necessary.
And that's what I think. I'm sorry, did I understand your train of thought? Overarching, bonding privilege doesn't apply. But moving on to the knowingly component of burglary offense, what you're saying is that the subjective component of that necessarily hinges on their subjective belief that, in fact, it does apply, mm-hmm. and therefore would be circumscribed by the parameters of that privilege as outlined either in the bonding contract or in Taylor. So the if necessary and, the reasonable belief piece. Is that, Correct. Am I following you? Okay.
I see my time is up. I'll be back in 15 minutes.
Thank you. Thank both attorneys for the argument. The case will stand submitted on the briefs, and we